This is August 9th, 2006, and I'm Kimberly Hill talking with Martha Jane Patton in the Legal Aid Society of Birmingham office. How are you doing, ma'am?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Thank you for having me today.
Oh, thank you for coming on such a hot day.
My pleasure. So you were just telling me about Ruby Sales and the Episcopal priest named Jonathan Daniels, and you were about to tell me about the activism you did in high school.
Yes, joining the Selma Interreligious Project, which was the group that came after Jonathan's martyrdom, was not my first involvement in the civil rights movement, although it had come mostly through the church. As a young person, I had been involved in my church's youth group, which we called at that time EYC, Episcopal Young Churchmen at the time. And I grew up going to Camp McDowell, which is the Episcopal Church camp here in Alabama, and met a lot of interesting people, including the two youth leaders, Bill Yon and Peggy Roop. She was called Peggy Horn at the time. Anyway, Peggy introduced me to the United Christian Youth Movement, which was the first interracial group that I ever belonged to. And we went to, I remember going to a camp in Tennessee, which was the first time that most of us, in fact all of us in Decatur, who were on the trip, had ever been around black people our own age. And there we were sharing dorm space together, and it was such an eye-opener. I mean, if you can imagine growing up in the South where the only black people that were ever referred to or that you ever personally knew were servants of, you know, your friends or, you know. It was just incredible to be able to meet each other and get to know each other on a personal basis. And of course, we were there to do Bible study. But the interesting part was in the dorm at night when people were looking at how the others fixed their hair, you know, and all this sort of thing. It was very interesting, and being young people, there were a lot of real open and honest questions and things said. And so
what
it was such.
What kind of questions did you ask?
Oh, gosh, you know, like, why do you put that on your hair? You know, do you do that? Do you put your hair in those rollers every night? They would ask us, and we did back then, you know. So it was fascinating, just, you know, those kinds of things that only young girls would be concerned about. But, you know, there was a deeper aspect to it in that we were doing Bible study and we were specifically thinking about racial reconciliation even in the early 1960s when this was happening. And so I started growing a different attitude from my family and friends. And then, of course, there were some very precipitous events, in particular President Kennedy's assassination in 1963. At the time, I was the editor of the school newspaper, and I printed an editorial. I think the headline was, "How Can Any Cheer at Death?" Because there were people that were cheering when they heard that President Kennedy had been killed in my high school, if you can believe it.
Did you know why they were?
Well, they saw him as a liberal and somebody that was promoting, quote, race mixing. And, I mean, when you look back at history, he certainly wasn't any radical in that respect. But he was seen that way, and at the time, this is, you know, right before, I think Goldwater was a popular senator and was making a challenge to for the presidency. So, yes, and then you also have to consider that North Alabama was the birthplace of the KKK. And while I never personally saw a Klan rally, I was certainly aware that they were happening. It was no secret in Decatur. So, you know, with this different attitude, and I was not the only one. I had other friends in different denominations in youth activities. We decided we would form the Decatur chapter of the United Christian Youth Movement, and we would have interracial meetings at each other's churches. Well, my church wasn't too keen on that, but the Methodists were okay, and they let us have meetings in their church basement. Well, that was scandalous enough. But the crowning blow was when several of us decided that, kind of on the spur of the moment, that we were going to go picket George Wallace at Prior Field, which is a little airstrip north of Decatur. At the time, there was no airport. That was the closest thing to an airport we had. Mm-hmm. And so we went out there in the evening and were present when he landed. And we had made our handmade posters to stand there and hold, and we formed our little picket line so that he could come down and read all of our posters.
How many of you were there?
I think there were 7 or 8 of us. And I remember what my poster said. It said, "George Wallace doesn't hate Negroes. He thinks everyone should own one."
Ooh.
Right. They were not nice signs. They were in-your-face messages, okay? Well, he walked down and stood right in front of me and looked me up and down and had that kind of sneering look that he used to wear back then. Turned around and remarked to one of the state troopers, "See, I told you they were beatniks. She's wearing tennis shoes." Wearing tennis shoes was, you know, kind of a sign that you were a liberal or something, I guess, to him.
Or that you like comfortable feet, but that's okay.
So anyway, a little item about this appeared in the Decatur Daily the next morning. Barrett Shelton was the editor of the paper up there, and he's been a fearless publisher for a long time. So he put it in the newspaper, not a big article, just a little one. And suddenly all of us who were the honor students at our high school, and this is just weeks before our graduation, were called down to the principal's office. And, you know, I don't recall everything that was said, but it was clear that we had embarrassed our city and our high school by being the first people who had ever picketed George Wallace in his home state. Okay.
It's actually rather special.
I take great pride in that, mm-hmm. that I was one of several people who picketed him, and first people to picket him in his home state. Somebody had to be the first. So that was kind of where I was in high school. And at the time, of course, you know what was happening in Birmingham in 1963, the Church Street, 16th Street Church bombing. And on occasion, I would come down here with people and we would meet and other young people in church basements, and they were planning sit-ins. But those were mostly during the week, and so we had to be back in Decatur and be in school, and so we weren't really able to participate in the sit-ins. But we were aware of them and in on some of the planning meetings. Mm-hmm. And my parents never knew any of this. I mean, they would not have approved. Of course, they did find out about the picket line, because that was pretty public knowledge. And
so how did you find a way to do all of this planning and travel without
find out? You know, I traveled with the young people, and that's when we would do it. you know, we'd come down for a conference, a church conference that would last over the weekend, and then several of us would get in somebody's car and we'd go to a meeting. We'd just cut out on the church meeting for a little while. And I think our youth leaders knew what we were up to. You know, they didn't encourage it or condone it, but they didn't stop it. You know, I think they probably in their own mind were very glad that we were doing it. And of course, they were doing what they could as adults, despite the fact that at the time our Episcopal bishop was pretty recalcitrant on race issues. He was one of the ones that was sent Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail. He is one of the ones that had asked Dr. King not to continue his demonstrations in Birmingham. And so he was one of the recipients of the letter. And Peggy Horn worked in the diocese in the same office with that bishop. So, you know, it was only so out front you could be. But there was a lot of clandestine things like that going on with young people. And it was young people. It was the young people in Birmingham that were the movement. It was young people everywhere. We're now the baby boomers who are in our 60s now.
Well, of the Episcopal people who were involved, did they ever give any theological or spiritual reasons why they felt compelled to join in?
No, they just thought, I think it, by the time Dr. King was writing all these local ministers and bishops, the theological aspects of the movement were clear, but there was the, let's take it slow, you know, let's take baby steps, let's not take this to the streets, let's have calm and reasoned meetings with the powers that be. And of course, those kinds of meetings had never resulted in any change. It was only the power of the press that really brought change to bear in the movement. And the outrage of people in other parts of the country and internationally. In 1963, I remember going on a trip with young people to Coventry, England. I don't know if you know about Coventry, but
no, I don't.
There's a large English cathedral there that was destroyed by German bombings in the early 40s. And so that it was just a skeletal remains of the cathedral, but someone had taken charred beams and placed them and made a rudimentary cross and written with ashes below, "Father, forgive." And so those words and that whole attitude became the impetus for building a modern cathedral right next to the ruins and ashes, which still stands. And so there was instituted, and again, Peggy Horn, another person who was instrumental in getting a group of young people together to go in the summertime for service and study. And we served as guides and the tour guides in the cathedral and worked in the bookstore and different things and met with other young people from all over the world who came to do similar work and discussed Gandhi and, you know, reconciliation issues. And it was a very powerful learning for somebody who was only, I think I was 17 at the time. And why did I bring this up? Oh, because the international aspect. For the first time, I saw my own country and my own state and city as an international person would see it. And they were outraged. And, it was just a totally different reaction than what I got daily from the people I lived with, my family and friends and classmates. And so that was a tremendous influence.
What were your perceptions of poverty as you were growing up in Decatur?
I'm ashamed to even talk about it. But then again, I think each of us carries our own attitudes into adulthood from our childhood. But I'm afraid it was, well, these are people who brought this on themselves.
Did you know many poor people?
No. My parents were not wealthy, but it was, at the time, considered a measure of middle-class success to have a housekeeper. And my mother never worked outside the home, but we had a housekeeper, a lady who came and did washing and ironing and cleaning. Mm-hmm. And I knew her, and when we drove her home, I saw her children. I wasn't allowed to get out and play, but I saw where she lived and I saw her children playing. That's about as far as it went. Mm-hmm. Never knew anybody. Mm. Yeah, I mean, that weekend in Tennessee at the UCYM was my first exposure. Yeah. Ever, aside from, and that was very typical. And that exposure came earlier for me than it did for the vast majority of people in Alabama.
Mm-hmm. So we don't have to skip to college yet if you don't want to, but you were in college here from 64 to 68.
I was. And boy, I just thought that would be so exciting to be in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. But another part of me was a little concerned because, you know, here I was, I'd already gotten in trouble in high school, and boy, if I went down to Birmingham, I was going to get in some big trouble. And my parents had signed this, actually, it was what they didn't sign. The college was very protective of its young women at the time. In 1964, Birmingham Southern did not have the giant fence around it that it has now. That only happened after a young student was killed. Oh. Somewhat later, that they built the whole, walled it in and created the gated campus that it is now. At the time, it was fairly wide open. But the rules were is you weren't supposed to go off campus unless you had your parents' permission in writing. And my parents would not give that. So I was virtually a prisoner on the campus. I think by then they knew what I would be doing. And there was a lot of interaction between the students at Southern and the students at Miles, because the Miles was close by. Mm-hmm. And I was aware of that, and talking to those students, the guys mostly, who were allowed to go off campus. There were no such rules for them. But I will never forget in 65, sitting in the dorm room with my good friend Sandra and watching the Selma to Montgomery march on my dorm mother's TV and saying, oh, I wish I was there. Oh, I'd give anything to be there. My dorm mother saying, what in the world would you not want to be down there and all that for? You know, and I'd say, oh, why would my mother let me go? You know, oh, I would be there in a New York second. So that pretty much curbed my activities, and mm-hmm. really Birmingham Southern was hardly integrated at that time. I did know, I think, the first two or three black students that were on campus. And I talked to them because, you know, they were interested. But, you know, it was a hard school, and you had to spend most of your time studying, truth be known. And mm-hmm. So I did immerse myself in that, and then, you know, campus life. And ended up writing things for the newspaper and going on to be editor of the yearbook. Somehow journalism was calling me, I thought, at the time, and I had gone there on a scholarship because of a short story I had written, which was really about the race issue at the time in high school. And my high school English teacher had submitted it to the National Council Teachers of English, and then I'd ended up getting this full scholarship to Birmingham Southern because of it. And it was a dinky little story, you know, at the time, but it seemed way out there, and I guess the subject matter was appealing to the judges. I ended up getting an English major and not going on into journalism. And when I look back, I mean, I think, okay, well, there was this second movement had not hit me yet. The women's movement had, despite all my civil rights interests, I still had very traditional notions about what was going to happen in my life, and it was pretty much what was happening with all the women around me. You know, we were going to have our degrees and maybe work a few years, and then we'd get married and have children. So I was not career-minded, really, with my English degree, and I didn't feel called to teach. So I graduated with, as they would think of it now, this useless degree. Fortunately, it had occurred to me in my senior year that I needed some marketable skills, so I had taken typing and shorthand. And I went to work in a law office downtown and worked there for 3 years before, and it was fascinating, you know, to be around lawyers and all that, but I didn't think of myself going to law school at the time at all. This was just a job until I could find somebody and get married.
Right.
So, I'm afraid I was very unemancipated myself, and enjoying my independence too, because here I was, big girl in Birmingham, own apartment, you know, away from my little provincial life in Decatur, and you know, you're talking 1968 to 71 here. There was a lot going on. It was a fun time to be a young person. And especially living in an apartment on the South Side. It was all peace and love, and, you know, I mean, I spent my spare time doing things like listening to music with friends and going to concerts and hanging out in the park and throwing frisbee, but I still had that thing that my friends didn't have inside, and I wanted to make a difference, you know. And I just thought, I dated a black medical student for a while, and you know, he and I would talk about, you know, what was going on, but we couldn't really go out anywhere in Birmingham. Even then, we'd have to go to Atlanta, and then people would look at us like, oh, you know, that was still very unusual, even in 69 and 70.
Is that because you knew that there were still segregation laws that would get you in, like, legal trouble for going out, or you're worried about people saying things?
He was more concerned about people saying things than I was. You know, I was this young hippie chick. Free spirit, you know, I was going to do my own thing, and so I didn't really, it didn't bother me at all, but, you know, his family lived here, and they were very nice people, and I'm sure if they'd known about me, they would not have approved.
Mm-hmm.
So, we finally decided that, you know, the way things were, it just wasn't possible for us to have a relationship. And then, of course, he immersed himself in med school, as he should have. But the whole time I felt restless, and I read political things. There was a lot of politics going around, too. And of course, then the war in Vietnam became a big issue at that time, too. So finally, I thought, I gotta make a difference. So I applied for a job with the Literacy Council, and they didn't have a job, but somebody over there knew that the Selma Project was looking for somebody who could run an office. Well, here I was with all this typing and shorthand and office administrative skills, so I went to and worked and joined the Selma Project. And that was 71 to 74. And our office, despite the name, was not in Selma. It was in Tuscaloosa.
Okay.
But our area of work was basically the Black Belt area, which of course is not named Black Belt because of, for racial reasons, but because of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent those 3 or 4 years traveling in that area, working with community groups that had names like the Lowndes County Civic Improvement Association. You know, every county had its own improvement association, and mostly they were about economic justice. We helped people get SBA grants. We provided what we called technical assistance, but of course we were part of the movement and what people were doing in those counties. And we helped with the technical aspects of setting up the Freedom Quilting Bee in Wilcox County. And we're very close to the people in Wilcox County in G's Bend. And I used to go down and spend weekends there and stay in their houses. And
that's where they make those world-famous quilts.
That's right. And Francis Walter actually probably doesn't get enough credit, but he discovered them when he was driving around in there, in that area, and meeting people. He saw these incredible quilts mm-hmm. hanging on the line. And these were women that just working out of their homes. There was no jobs, and there was no way to get across the river to Camden. You had to drive all the way around about 40 miles or so to even get over to Camden, which was the county seat, just a little country town. But, you know, that was where all the commerce and stores were. And so, just for survival, these women had been making these quilts for, I guess, several decades. And they, I don't know if you've ever seen them.
Just pictures.
Well, the pictures cannot do justice. Right now, the exhibit is in San Francisco, but if it ever comes your way and you ever have a chance to go, you need to go see that. Those women were just incredibly powerful influences on me. And they were living in poverty, but it was the kind of exuberant happiness that Jonathan Daniels had picked up from them. That's where it came from in him, because he had been living among these people. And I'm not talking about, oh, the happy black people living in the, I'm not talking about that stereotype. I'm talking about a real joy of living that deeply affected me. And realizing that material things don't really have anything to do with happiness in life. It's your relationships and your spiritual self that makes a difference.
Well, if somebody had asked you to describe what kind of city Birmingham was, like in that time when you were in college and even when you were in Tuscaloosa, what would you have said?
Dirty. It was physically dirty. To live in western part of Birmingham was to, somebody said, was to breathe the equivalent of smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, just to breathe the air. There was so much particular matter in the air. The streets, the curbs, the sidewalks, everything just had a layer of dirt. Downtown was physically dirty. And of course, that was the iron and steel industry, which was king then. All the people who had left rural Alabama and come to work at the turn of the century were all a part of that movement of coming to the city and being a part of that industry, but it was dirty.
I guess it didn't take very long after the plant's closing for that to go away.
Well, it's improved. It's still, we don't have the best air, but that has to do with geography more than anything else. You know, we're in a ridge and valley area. And so Birmingham being in the bottom here, where we're sitting today, of a valley, Jones Valley, forms kind of a bowl effect. So any kind of air pollutants, especially in the summer, just gather and hover so that we don't have the best air here. Mm-hmm. But it's not the dirty particulate you breathed every day. I mean, when you blew your nose, it was black.
You could see it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was dirty.
Well, what accomplishments would you have said that the local civil rights movement caused by the end of the 60s?
Well, I think the Jim Crow laws were gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the public accommodations, transportation, all those barriers were down. School desegregation had happened. You know, the de jure part, segregation was gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there specific things that you hoped you could change if you started getting more involved?
Oh, I longed for more interaction, more sense of community. It troubled me that people were moving out to the suburbs so that they could still maintain a segregated lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It troubled me that city government was no longer able or willing to support public facilities like our parks and transportation and all the things that worked so well before. You know, when they declared that the public parks were desegregated, Birmingham shut them down rather than integrate them. And that was really the last money that they spent on parks until the last decade or so. And so most of our beautiful parks went crumbling and unnoticed and unused.
I've noticed that when I went to this one downtown, just looking at the statues and things, how they're really in disrepair.
Yeah, it's sad. There is, you know, some change in the air, and there are people who have stayed in the city and have been very committed to being here and being a part of change in Birmingham. I would count myself among those because I still live in the city limits and with my family, and very intentionally so. And there are many other people like myself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not been easy for us. I know we had a group of white families that went through the school system, K through 12, and by the time we hit middle school, our kids were the only ones there. So they were in the vast minority, and it was difficult. You know, the girls didn't feel like there were people they could date. Mm-hmm. There was still a lot of hostility, but of course they were on the minority side then. You know, my son and his friends would get beat up, and here, you know, I named my oldest son Jonathan. You can guess why.
Yeah.
You know, and he's a sixth and seventh grader, and I'm trying to give him lessons in nonviolent action, and you know, he's getting beat up. So, you know, it hadn't been easy, but you know, we graduated from Ramsey High School. I say we, because I feel like I went through.
Involved.
I was very involved in PTA and everything all the way through. But there are few and fewer people who are willing to do as our group did. And now, unfortunately, Birmingham schools have gotten so bad, even the black families are moving out of Birmingham. There was a big article in Sunday's paper about that. You know, you kind of worry what's going to happen in the vacuum.
The tax base will decrease?
Oh, it has. It absolutely has.
The schools won't get any better.
Oh, no. It's all literally falling in. It's imploding. Except that there are people like my son and kids his age who grew up in our households who don't want to leave. And they're moving into lofts downtown. And, you know, I have a lot of faith and hope in that generation.
How do your children feel about their school experience now?
They never liked school, I'll be honest with you, neither of my sons. And they were anxious to get out of school and away from school.
Mm-hmm.
I think as young adults now, they have some regrets that probably a lot of kids that didn't do all that well in school would have. Like, wow, I wish I could have studied a little harder. And I mean, one of Jonathan's best friends made a perfect score on her SAT.
Ooh.
So he realizes a good education was there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that he didn't avail himself of it.
Hmm.
But school was a battleground for him, and you know, and all I had friends is, why are you doing this to your child? Isn't his education important to you? And you know, and so I think, well, should I have done that? Sometimes I have doubts myself, but you know, my kids don't have those prejudices that we had. They just don't. They freely interact with people of all races. They just have no problems. Their taste in music and fashion and everything are all so eclectic, and it's a source of joy for me, even though, you know, they're not, you know, going to the best colleges and things. They're in college and they're getting their degrees, and it's the local schools, but that's all right, you know. That's all right. I feel like they're better equipped to deal with life in some ways than some of their friends whose parents decided, no, I'm putting you in private school, or we're moving to Vestavia, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, overall, while I can get a little defensive about it, I'm still glad we did what we did.
Let's turn to a little more about your legal work.
Okay.
So what led to you eventually deciding to go to law school?
It was the women's movement.
Oh, okay.
While I was working with the Selma Project, the women who worked there and the wives of the men who worked there were all part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And it all hit us about the same time. I think we had the first consciousness raising group in Tuscaloosa. And it was like, wait a minute here. How come we're doing all this dead end stuff, you know, and we're supporting the supportive role in our relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And it was there. Boy, I'm gonna tell some stuff now.
Okay.
But I had a crush on one of the lawyers at the Selma Project, and we went out a couple times. And then one of the foundation people came down for her annual visit. A beautiful woman named Marjorie worked with a foundation in New York, and she was a Harvard-educated lawyer. She came down for her annual visit to see what we were doing with their money, you know, and travel around the Black Belt with us and meet people. And then we had a dinner at somebody's house at night, and Marjorie just held court. She was so interesting. She was so articulate. And the men were just at her feet, these lawyers, you know, that worked with the Selma Project. You know, Ralph was one of them. And so he ended up, after this dinner, going out to have a beer or something with her. And I was so jealous. Anyway, I thought, I have nothing to say. She is gorgeous and smart and, you know, and here I am. I feel so inferior to her, you know. So long about that time, you know, we're in this consciousness raising group, and we're all talking about how there's no need for us to be inferior. You know, we can do these things too. And then I got to know Marjorie a little bit better, and I took her course in women's studies, just not for college credit or anything, just to take it. And what an eye-opener. All these principles that I had been applying to my civil rights and racial thinking, hey, you know, I could, it was like the light bulb came on. And especially one day when she said, you know, you're smart. Have you considered going to law school?
Hmm.
And here I am. I've worked in a law office before. They're male lawyers in my extended family. Had it ever occurred to me to go to law school? No. Until that moment when she said, have you ever thought about going to law school? Well, you know, so my friends are, you know, helping me think through this. So I take the LSAT, and I did pretty well. Not as well as I thought I should, but then I'd been out of school for 7 years, so I thought, I'm going to study for a little bit. I'm going to take this again. I think I can improve my score. So I did, and I improved my score greatly, and I applied, and I got in Cumberland here in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I ended up in law school. Plus the notion that I could do the things for other people like the lawyers for the Selma Project were doing for people. You know, that was just incredible that I didn't have to be in a support role. I could do that, you know. And so, you know, Marjorie just became a dear friend and, you know, no longer the object of my envy. You know, I could be her equal, you know.
You can make other people into you.
Oh, well, you know, that was an incredible time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of putting all this together. So I ended up in law school. Right before I'd gone to law school, though, I'd had this kind of interim job. Francis Walter had finally, after all these years, left the Selma Project, and they had passed me over for the directorship and hired this guy from out of state, which was unthinkable to me at the time. It was one of the things we took pride in, that was we were not outside agitators. We were all Alabamians,
mm-hmm.
you know. So they couldn't say that about us. And now they were bringing in this Northeasterner, you know. So I just couldn't take that. So I got myself another job, knowing that I was on my way to law school. It was just for a year, working under a grant, writing a study of the juvenile justice systems of 10 West Alabama counties. So I wrote that study up. In the process, I had met Professor Annette Dodd, who taught juvenile justice courses at Cumberland. And she had kind of recruited me for Cumberland and said, when you get ready to send in your application, don't send it to the admissions office, send it to me. And then after I'd sent it in, about 2 days later, I got my admissions letter. So I
nice.
Know she hand-walked that down to the dean and said, I want her here, you know. So she helped me, and I appreciated that. And then, you know, because of her, I developed an interest in juvenile justice
mm-hmm.
and ended up working out at the girls, state girls detention facility out at Chalkville here as an ombudsman. So I really developed that interest in while I was still before law school and kept it during law school. And now, of course, the Legal Aid Society, most of what we do is represent kids.
I didn't know that. I was going to ask.
Yeah. The legal aid movement is an old one in the country. We're not connected to each other, though, the way legal services is. In many cities, that, for example, in Atlanta, the Legal Aid Society applies for and administers the legal services grant. But here in Alabama, those are bifurcated. And so our Legal Aid Society just is sponsored by the Birmingham Bar, and we are local.
Okay.
Whereas Legal Services is the federally funded group that operates statewide.
So what are the special legal needs of youth, especially in this area?
Well, we do two kinds of cases. We do delinquency defense, which those are, you know, of course, the children that are arrested for what would be a crime if they were an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Although that line is getting so blurred now.
Between youth
kids
and adults.
Younger and younger are being treated like criminals. It is not the juvenile court that was envisioned at the turn of the century, where the idea was to pick young people up and help them turn their lives around and become a success. Unfortunately, those principles have been lost, in my opinion.
Hmm.
And they're treated like young criminals. Then, of course, an even larger part of our work is being guardians ad litem for abused and neglected children. And unfortunately, that's growing.
Mm-hmm.
We have 13 lawyers on staff who just represent children, 4 who represent adults.
Wow.
And the adults are, that's actual criminal defense where they're serving as their lawyers.
Is it usual for a legal aid society to have to concentrate on youth issues?
Yeah, it is unusual. And it's peculiar to Birmingham, and it's sort of tied into the reasons that the Legal Aid Society and legal services were bifurcated. The Legal Services Corporation was, I think, the last stroke of Nixon's pen before he left office, and it was designed to provide representation for people in civil matters. You know, the law already required appointed attorneys in criminal cases, and up to a certain level. But there was nobody helping people with landlord-tenant problems, consumer debt, all kinds of people problems that, you know, poor folks can't afford to pay lawyers to help them with, but they obviously are in dire circumstances and need this kind of help. Mm-hmm. So Legal Services was formed, and in most instances, the legal aid societies all over the country rose up and said, oh yes, we'll apply for it and administer those federal grants, and we'll start doing, well, actually they already were doing the civil work. We were in Birmingham, supported by the bar. Anyway, with federal money comes federal strings, and I've never gotten anything in writing about any of this. This is all hearsay, but I've talked to enough people who are around in 1975 and the latter part of the 70s to know that it was a controversial issue in Birmingham, especially when at the beginning the legal services group started filing lawsuits, class actions, that sort of thing. Well, you know, you're talking about the people that give to a United Way. You're talking about your big philanthropy folks in Birmingham, and now their companies are being sued by this group. And so there was a separation, and the Birmingham Bar, you know, decided, okay, Legal Aid is going to do this, and y'all are going to administer the federal money, and we'll help incorporate you. Okay. And then Legal Services money was cut nationally at some point, and there were some pretty tough restrictions placed on the kinds of cases that they could handle. They could no longer do these class action cases and bring in any fee-producing work. So, and now probably if the issue were on the table today, we would not be bifurcated, but at this point it's so historically ingrained that we will probably always be two groups here.
Okay. Do you, have you had much interaction with local politics in your work?
Yes, collaterally, mostly.
Okay.
I've only been a candidate 2 or 3 times. I ran for a judicial position in 1988.
Okay.
And most years where there's a presidential election going on, I run as a delegate to the convention. But I am on the Democratic Executive Committee for the county.
Okay.
And I'm a member of the what they call the Downtown Democrats.
Downtown Democrats, mm-hmm. I like that. Did you ever work with the Arrington administration?
Not directly. I supported him. I was very excited the night he was elected, and I think I was one of only a few people that were standing in the, few white people that were standing in the Parliament House for his celebration party. That was very exciting. Yeah. And I supported him all through his term in office. Toward the end, it was right after I had come on with Legal Aid, mm-hmm. and I had been in private practice for 20 years. When I came on with Legal Aid, the organization was struggling to renew its contract with the City of Birmingham to represent people in the municipal court. And I thought, well, I know Dick Arrington. If y'all hire me, I can straighten this out. And unfortunately, he went out of office without our straightening it out.
Oh.
And I never really quite understood that, because I felt like I'd been a loyal supporter. But I think his loyalties were stronger in another direction, regrettably. So that was a sad
end. What would be the other option to not letting you represent people in municipal court?
Well, boy, I'm going to be talking again now. I don't know what you're going to do with all this.
It'd go in a library, but if you mention a name or something that you don't want on there, we can work it out.
Well, you know, we're all still licking our wounds from this because it was not that long ago. Mm-hmm. But at the time, the presiding municipal judge was the daughter of his best friend, and she was appointing Congressman Hilliard's daughter to do defense work in her personal courtroom while our lawyer sat there and did nothing all day.
Mm-hmm.
And she would not respond to me, answer my letters or phone calls or anything like that, you know, to try to discuss the contract renewal. And so I appealed to Mayor Arrington, and then I got the cold shoulder there too. So it was only when he went out of office that we were able to resolve things.
Sounds like it was just a matter of cronyism then.
I'm afraid so.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk some about your solo practice, and especially the civil litigation and employment discrimination. Because I've talked with Bob Wiggins before, mm-hmm. about the employment discrimination cases that he's handled. And how did most of the cases that you handle originate?
Okay. There were only a handful of us, three or four of us in Birmingham,
mm-hmm.
that would take those cases on.
I didn't know that.
This was before the laws were changed. Now you have right to a jury trial, you have a right to collect attorney's fees if you win. There are all these changes in the law that have made them more attractive to lawyers. But at the time, mm-hmm. you didn't get that. So, first of all, you were trying your case in front of a judge only, and if you prevailed, you might or might not get paid, and, you know, depending on what kind of contract you had with your client, and if it was all back wages, then you felt bad about taking a percentage of somebody's pay, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I, you know, rushed in where angels fear tread, handled a few of those. Got burned probably more than I won, but you know, I had some success on appeals.
What companies were you going against?
Well, boy, the biggest and longest one was Revere Copper and Brass Company. I represented I think there were 11 plaintiffs who were the first women who had ever worked in their plant up in Scottsboro. And this case went on forever and ever and ever. In the end, we did manage to get a fairly decent settlement, but they were a fearsome group of women. They were the first women that had ever worked in that plant. They put up with a lot. I sued HealthSouth.
Mm-hmm.
I sued a local tire company that I think has gone out of business. UAB.
On behalf of the employees union?
No, these were all individual plaintiffs.
Oh, okay.
except for the Scottsboro group. Boy, it's hard to remember all this because it was a long time ago. Yeah, I've been practicing law for 30 years now. And I've got old files in the file boxes in the basement here, but it's really been a while since I thought about some of those cases. And then, as I said, once the law changed, you know, there were firms who concentrated in those areas, and they developed quite a reputation. And at the time, I was solo, or there was a period of time that I was in a very small firm. And it's difficult to finance these cases as they go along. The defense on the other side has a lot of money, and they schedule every deposition in the world. And you know, you could easily drop $15,000 or $20,000 of your own money into a case, and with no guarantee that you were going to prevail or get that back, because your plaintiffs are out of work. You know, they can't pay for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I became a lot more careful about the cases I took. And then, of course, because I wasn't taking as many and not concentrating only in that field, eventually that's the way law practice has gone now. It's highly specialized.
I was asking because I remember Mr. Wiggins saying how legally savvy his plaintiffs were, that they did all the research and they would have regular meetings, like even meetings inside 16th Street Baptist Church, and discuss every different aspect of the case,
mm-hmm.
even though they weren't college-educated people.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, I think even of the individuals. Now, he has represented more groups and class action kinds of cases than I have, but even individuals would be very well prepared.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Except for this one lady. This was a sad case.
Oh.
Yeah, she was claiming that her employer had put her into a hostile work environment. And she was very convincing. I didn't actually take on the case. At the time, I was in a small firm, and one of the partners had taken on the case, but he ended up, you know, getting me to prepare it. And I'll never forget, one of her claims was that she had gone to a business holiday gathering and that there were people there in blackface. It was a Halloween thing. And that she was so offended by this. And throughout the litigation, the other side was saying, no, she's mistaken about that. You know, and I thought, how could anybody have been mistaken about that, you know? And then in trial, we were ambushed with their photograph of these two people in their costumes for the party and their dogs. Mm. They were dressed as dogs. They had dog ears and everything. Yes, they had painted their skin dark, but
to look,
yeah, they were dogs.
Okay.
And so we did not prevail in that case. And you know, you have faith in your clients sometimes when it's misplaced.
Well, I guess what concerned her most was that they painted their face.
Right.
But,
yeah. Mm. But, you know, she didn't check it out enough to go over and actually confront them and ask, you know, which maybe that's too much to ask of somebody. You know, if you see somebody across the room and it looks offensive, I might hang over on my side of the room too, you know. But unfortunately, that was not the only hole in her story. story. So we went down on that one.
Well, what have been the highlights of your law practice over the years?
Wow.
Well, I guess some of them.
So many. I don't think they have come particularly in the civil rights arena. I've had more high points in my work representing people in juvenile court. Because there really have been opportunities to turn children's lives around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a great privilege to be a part of that. And it happens every day with our lawyers. People have no idea how important this work is.
Hmm.
When I think about somebody like Ruby Sales, for example, and how just some event and some association with other people has changed her life, you know, I realize, you know, the power of a suggestion that you're smart, why don't you go to law school? You know, people just don't even appreciate how much something like that, some little thing, can mean to a young person.
Mm-hmm.
You probably have your stories too, though.
People encouraging me?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I have many.
Sure. Well, I certainly have too. And it's great to be able to pass it on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the Foundation for Women's Health?
Well, that was an interesting chapter. And looking back on it, it was more corporately driven than I could see at the time. Brookwood Hospital was competing against other local hospitals for the maternal and child health business. And so it funded the initial operations and creation of the Foundation for Women's Health. And it was a wonderful group of women that I admire and respect, but sometimes I look back on it and think, well, we kind of allowed ourselves to be used.
Hmm. What did you hope to accomplish?
Well, we hoped to bring a lot of focus and change in the women's health movement. And I can't say that we were totally unsuccessful, because as a part of that, I did get on the governor's task force on infant mortality. I was the only consumer member. Everybody else was in the healthcare profession. And I mean, there were many examples of things like that that I and the other women at the foundation did. Plus, we learned a lot of self-help things, one of which has saved my life later. Breast self-exam, back in 2003, I found a lump in my breast, and it was breast cancer. And, you know, I did have surgery and am being treated for this kind of long term. And so, I mean, I can't say that I got nothing out of the Foundation for Women's Health. I got my life from it.
Yeah.
You know, but I do think that it died a natural death after, you know, Brookwood got its certificate of need. And of course, Brookwood does now probably enjoy one of the more prominent roles in maternal health care in the city now as a result of that.
Let's talk about how you got involved with Alabama Arise.
Alabama Arise?
Mm-hmm.
What a great organization. I cannot remember how I first heard about it, but I was very excited that my own church wanted to participate. And so I'm the liaison for our church with the group overall. And it just fits right into every advocacy organization I've ever been involved with. You know, it's out there on the front lines working in the legislature and educating people about what's happening in government. Wonderful organization.
Yeah, I've talked with Angie Wright and Scott Douglas about
it. Oh, yes. Yes. We had some big victories this year in the legislature. Got some changes in the landlord-tenant laws for the first time, and got the floor of the tax obligation level raised to from 4,000 something to 12,000, so that people in that income bracket don't have to pay taxes till they get up to the 12,000 mark now, state income taxes, that is. So very significant group. Great warriors.
Has working on poverty at a state level had any impact on how you view local poverty?
Oh, it's all enmeshed. I mean, these are our clients. You know, the adults that we represent. And unlike my childhood attitude about poverty, I no longer blame these people for their own poverty. You know, I see how economic circumstances and their own backgrounds have created this for them. And want to do everything I possibly can to encourage people and groups to come up out of it. And if I can turn that light bulb on for anybody the way it has been turned on for me, I certainly intend to continue doing that.
Well, your church helped you get involved with Alabama Arise.
Yes.
Have you noticed a drastic change in church people's attitudes towards civil rights, poverty issues?
Over the years, it's like night and day. Oh, yes. In my denomination, it's been a huge change. And I think the Episcopal Church, both nationally and locally, is very focused on issues around poverty from a personal way to a global way. I know our denomination is supporting the Millennium Development Goals. We also, you know, have a soup kitchen that feeds a hot meal every single day and holidays. I would not say that we have arrived at true community, but it's now not uncommon for the people who are there to get a meal to be mixing and mingling with church members, you know, at coffee hour afterwards and helping themselves to the goodies and having a cup of coffee and, you know, conversing. And, you know, we got people that just come in off the street and they're welcomed. And, you know, there's some who are who become members who look to the community as a whole to help them move or get a job or, you know, if they've been in the hospital, take food to them. I'm very privileged to have a wonderful church community.
Which church is it?
St. Andrew's Episcopal. It's on the south side here.
Okay.
It's one of the denominational, major denominations that did not move to the suburbs in the 60s. although it was tempting, I'm sure. But there was it was real intentional that they were going to stay and be a part of the community and the neighborhood, and we have. So here we are. And, you know, I'm sure there are people who self-eliminate them. So, you know, once they realize, hey, we are and what we're up to over there, they go, oh, I don't think I want to drink from the same communion cup with that person, you know. But they leave. And it's okay.
Yeah, I've met with the headmistress at Church of the Advocate. No, Church of the Advent. Uh-huh. And with the teacher over at the Catholic Church. No, the Catholic High School, now I've forgotten its name. And yeah, they told me.
Our Lady, OLS, Our Lady of Sorrows, Holy Family.
It's a shame I don't remember which one it is.
Okay.
But they've also told me how staying within the city limits has kind of changed the vision of their church or school. But they've risen to the challenge and it's helped it become a better place, they believe. Definitely a more integrated place.
Yes.
Well, of all the organizations that you've been involved in, do you feel that you've made more progress in some than in others? I know
yes.
It's a big question.
Yes. And it's sometimes it's more of a qualitative issue than quantitative. But I think about Friends of Avondale Park, for example. Avondale Park had been neglected, as all the other parks had been, since the 1960s. It was most of the structures there were WPA, fieldstone buildings, and that sort of thing, and just crumbling and fell out of use. And in the 70s, that particular park kind of became a drug haven. But it was beautiful, 37 acres, a little fish pond in the middle of it, and a nice hill with a gorgeous building at the top that we called the Villa. But it was vandalized terribly, and you know, all the windows broken and stuff written all over their walls, and you know, if you look down, you might not like what you saw on the ground. So one year, our PTA over at Avondale School was talking about Spring in the Park, and it was an annual event for the school children, and the neighborhood participated in it. And I said, well, how did it ever get the name Spring in the Park? Because it happens here at the school. And they said, oh, it used to be over at the park. You know,
I said, until people stopped.
Why did they stop doing that? Well, it's because nobody wants to go there anymore.
Yeah.
I said, so, yeah, I think I kind of understand why. I said, but, you know, that's a shame. Because it's beautiful over there. We need to do something. So there was a brand new park board director here, Melvin Miller, who moved here from Houston. So I got together a couple of other people from our PTA, community school group. We went over there and met with him. He said, so we want that park cleaned up and we're here to help. He says, well, you know, you can form your own group. Out in Houston, there were groups of what they call Friends of Some Park, you know, that were forming, and you know, but you'd have to incorporate and all this kind of stuff. And I know that it's expensive, and I thought, no, not too expensive. I'm a lawyer, I can do that. You know, so I incorporated us and served as the first president for about seven or eight years. And we managed to get a lot of focus in the park and worked to help to pass a bond issue that Mayor Arrington was proposing that would go toward park improvements. And then we got some of that money and did a master plan and completely cleaned it up, wow, and got them to put in a new playground and new landscaping and start tending the rose garden again and growing the roses. Oh, it's just beautiful. We're so proud. And then it's taken another 10 years to get them to renovate the villa, mm-hmm, but it just opened a couple months ago and it's now available for rental and use by the community, and it's just a gem in the crown of Birmingham. It's so beautiful up there. People haven't quite yet discovered it yet because it's kind of hidden in the trees, but
I'll go look for it.
And I think, you know, there it is. It's bordered by a racially mixed neighborhood, you know, and now these people are coming together there. My kids played Little League there, you know, with their school friends, and you know, there's concerts and things and family reunions, and people are using that park again, or they go take walks around the pond and look at the ducks or sit there and look at the stars at night. And that is just, I can't tell you how much satisfaction that gives me. It's like the Phoenix Rising, because that place was just absolutely horrible. And now it's, you know, a well-used park again. And the city has an investment in it because it's so nice. They're actually taking care of it again. So that's an organization that I felt I got a lot of personal satisfaction from. I'm sure there are others. I mean, I loved little things like the radio reading thing. I did that for a number of years. Reading to blind people, they have a little side band over on our public radio station. I thought one day, I went, you know, I read the paper every day. I'm kind of a newspaper junkie. and I like reading aloud. I always loved reading stories to my children, so I thought they were too big to be read to anymore. So I thought, well, I'll just go there and read the newspaper on the air. So I did that for several years. That gave me a lot of satisfaction.
It's a good project.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm the kind of person that if I join an organization, somehow or another, I end up being the president. I don't know how that happens, but I never... It's difficult for me to go into something that I'm not gung-ho about. And I guess people see my energy and enthusiasm and they like to jump on that. I tend to end up, you know, heading things up. And so I have to be kind of careful what I join these days, because I'm going to end up... doing a lot of work and it takes up a lot of my time.
Do you ever feel like you overextend yourself?
I just have to laugh because most of the time I feel like I'm doing really well to get from here to there with the right pieces of paper in my hand. And my secretary, Marilyn, is just a big help for helping me stay organized. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I'm so disorganized, I just don't have time to get organized.
Yeah.
You see my desk and my surroundings here, it's bedlam. I do real well to keep a lid on all that, and some days when something breaks down unexpectedly, it all comes tumbling down. I know when my children were little, and I was trying to practice law, you know, it was such a struggle if somebody got sick, you know, because they, you know, they had to be at home. They couldn't go to school. And yeah, I had a trial going. And fortunately, I'm married to a wonderful man who had enough seniority at Bell South that he could take days off. And he's been a great dad and a great husband for me, somebody like me. He's as grounded as I am flighty.
Looking back, would you describe yourself as a civil rights activist?
Sure. Absolutely. You bet, and proud of it.
Then how would you define one?
How would I define one? Oh, somebody who understands the issues and wants to do something about it and does something within his or her power.
That's a good definition. I like that. Would you say many of your colleagues here in Birmingham would describe themselves that way?
Quite a few. We tend to group ourselves together.
Yeah.
Yeah. We like each other.
That's good. When you get the people who are willing to do things together.
Right.
That's when you know you're in a good environment.
It feeds your own energies, too, to be around positive people.
Well, compared to how this city was back in the 60s, how would you describe it now?
It's a lot cleaner.
Looks cleaner.
A lot friendlier and diversified economically and in the population. We haven't caught up with the rest of the world, and we still have a little bit of an inferiority complex when we compare ourselves with Atlanta, for example, or maybe even Nashville. We still have that gated mentality. That is, these are your problems and these are my problems and never the twain shall meet. Rather than focusing on our common problems and attacking them with some energy.
Do you think that gated mentality comes from all this suburban sprawl?
Or is absolutely.
Yeah.
That and, unfortunately, technology. You know, I grew up in the South before there was air conditioning. And while we enjoy it on a hot day like today, in another sense, it's kept us from being neighborly the way we used to. People used to sit on their porches and talk to each other and walk down the street. And now people seem so focused on getting to and from work and coming home and closing themselves up and watching their televisions or sitting in front of their computers. And so the things that have helped us communicate and become one big world have also isolated us.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Would you say that there are more options for poor residents of Birmingham as far as adequate employment and health care and housing than there were back in the 70s?
Unfortunately, I think so many entry-level jobs pay an unsurvivable wage. Alabama Rise has exposed me to some of the figures on what it really takes to live, and there are fewer and fewer jobs available that provide a livable lifestyle.
Well, last question. What lessons from your career and your life in general would you want others to remember?
That regardless of how far you make it in life or how far up the food chain you are, you're not disconnected from anybody else. and that you can't really gate yourself off from the world because you're in it and you're of it.
That's nice. Well, thank you for your time.
You're so welcome. And I wish I could sit here and ask you a lot of questions now. Find out all about you.
We could talk a little off tape.
Okay.